Welcome to Digging Deeper, a podcast from Perimeter Church in Atlanta, Georgia. I'm Jeff Norris. This is my co-host, Lars Story Elvington. And our goal is to equip you to follow Jesus by exploring the teachings and topics of the Bible, culture, and life.
We're so glad that you're here. And in this latest series, we're exploring God's heart for His people, the church, to live on mission for His glory. We're excited to be joined by so many amazing guests and to have you with us as we dig deeper into God's Word.
Now let's jump into today's discussion.
Welcome to the Digging Deeper podcast, a ministry of Perimeter Church. I am Laura Story Elvington, and my co-host, as you probably already know, is not here. He is out of town, but we wanted to go ahead without him because we had such a great opportunity for this week's guest. And I have Jimmy Kim joining me.
Hey, Laura.
Which some of you, probably most of you know, Jimmy is on our teaching team, has been on our staff here at Perimeter Church for almost 20 years or so.
15 okay. Years, yeah. But, you know, that's closer to 20 than it is to 10.
It is. Well, I'm glad to have you here with me today. I know that Jeff is really sad to miss it. But we had this great opportunity to have Rebecca with us. So welcome to our podcast.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am a professor of philosophy. I find that when I lead with that, the conversation dies down pretty quickly. So don't be put off by that. I always tell people I work in the part of philosophy that you would really love if you were in my class. It has to do with character formation, how to become a better person, how to be a better friend, how to live a wise, wisdom-loving life, how to raise your children well, all that kind of practical stuff. So it's philosophy, but philosophy for a good way of living.
Oh, I love that. And you've been at Calvin for 25 years?
Oh, just over 25 years.
Wow. Ah, that's amazing. Mm-hmm. Well, we are right in the middle of a series with our podcast called The Mission of the Church. And when we were contacted by someone, a Perimeter member, who told us that you were in town with the C.S. Lewis Institute, they said she may have a moment to pop over to Perimeter. And I'm so glad that you did. But you right now, I mean, there's so much that you're working on, I'm sure. But you have a book that you have just finished. And that is a lot of what I want you to share about, because it's on a topic that I have not seen a lot of books out there about, the seven deadly sins. Tell us about your new book a little bit.
Yeah, it's not in sort of your top 10 most winsome theological titles, right? So how do you defend the fact that you're coming from the Calvinist tradition and talking about sin and try to be inviting and winsome about the spiritual life? And actually, that is my goal. I mean, if there's anything that I want people to take away from reading this book, it's that you are so deeply loved by God that He wants to show you anything in your life, absolutely anything in your life that would get in the way of loving Him wholeheartedly and being loved back and receiving that love wholeheartedly. So as I say in the preface of the new edition, this is really a book about love and the ways in which our loves can kind of go off rail and stray away from God, and how we can get in our own way. And how God calls us back to Himself because He wants to invite us home.
Yeah, there was something also, I think, in a preface, or maybe it was in chapter one, where you had a student describe your 101 class, and they talked about your philosophy class as being spiritual formation. And that's a term that we use here at Perimeter a lot. In fact, I think we've talked about that on a previous episode, and how important spiritual formation is in the life of the believer. It's not simply I come to Jesus or Jesus meets me and I'm saved and then I'm done, right? It's this continual formation of the work of the Spirit in our lives, right? What we would call sanctification, right? Yeah, and so I love that. And the moment I read that, along with just keeping, you know, things on track, I was like, okay, I'm with this book. You know, sometimes I can get intimidated by the content of a book or the size of a book, but I've been all in. And so thank you for this work.
Well, the second edition is longer. So if you want a shorter book, read the first edition. but the second edition, I think helpfully, adds a chapter on spiritual formation, specifically at the end, because I wrote the original edition back in 2009. And I was speaking about the book and people would be like, I'm so convicted by all of this stuff. And now I don't know what to do. Where do I go next? What do I do next? And my thought was, well, I don't need to write a book on that stuff because there's so much good literature out there. I'll just point you to it. But the book didn't point anybody to it. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to make sure that that work got done in the second edition so that people weren't sort of left hanging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and you're talking about these sins in a, I love your term, glittering vices. And that's the title of the book. But tell us why, well, I have so many questions. Two main questions. Why glittering vices? What does that term mean? And also, I'd love to know what even got you interested in this particular topic. Why bring up something kind of from church history and begin to talk to our audience about it now?
There's a funny story about the title and a serious story. So, quick funny story. When I wrote the first edition, I submitted something like 10 different potential titles for the book to my publisher, who's quickly rejected all of them and picked Glittering Vices instead and designed this beautiful cover with the apple and everything, which I had nothing to do with, mm-hmm. absolutely nothing to do with. So shout out to the people with artistry and title mm-hmm. Inventing skills. Anyway, but they were right in picking that title because the story of the book is there are so many glittery, wonderful things in this world. I mean, God created them wonderful. But when we put those things at the center of our lives and build our lives around them, they function like idols. They mm-hmm. knock us off center and they derail us from a wholehearted life with God and send us down dead ends running after other things that leave us empty and unfulfilled. So the idea is sin is bad for you in part because it will make your life miserable. Hmm. I had a friend who once nicknamed my book Seven Ways to Ruin Your Life. And I was like, yeah, that's sort of that's the great. Right vibe. Mm-hmm. These are self-destructive paths. So I love to begin with kind of the wisdom literature of the Bible, which says, hey, the way of life is this way. And the way of not living well and even focusing on ways that will turn you away from God, that's this other way. Get on the right path. And I love that metaphor because it gives us a picture of spiritual formation as a pathway. It's not a one-off act or a one-off commitment. It's a path you have to keep living through and living down the rest of your life. So it's yeah. kind of ongoing progress happening, and there's directionality and there's formation. And so it invites all the kind of emphases that we're talking about in this tradition of living into a fuller life with God mm. as a process.
That's great. That's great.
You had a second question, though. Well, I can't remember what
it
was.
Your second question, I think, was why study this?
Oh, how did I get into it?
Yeah, how did you become interested in this?
This is great because I hope the book will do this for other people, too. But I found myself reading Thomas Aquinas, who's a 13th century theologian. I was reading this stuff in grad school, reading about virtues and vices. And I ran across this very odd little side vice that I'd never heard of before called pusillanimity. Okay. That's a tongue twister, yeah. right?
Wow.
And it was a kind of fearful shrinking back from all that God calls you to be. Think Moses at the burning bush, right? And you have an instant picture of pusillanimity. You might know it better as imposter syndrome, like, I don't really belong here. I don't know that if God's really calling me to do this because I feel totally unqualified. And I was reading through this book describing pusillanimity and thought, that's me. That's a perfect description for how I feel right now. And it was also, as I found out later, how everyone else in my grad program was also feeling right now. So we were all kind of all in it together, but not admitting it to each other, which is comical later, but still excruciating at the time. And I said, if this text can read me so well, if this wisdom tradition can read me this well, then I want to know more. Yeah. And I want to know what to do about what I find. So I tracked back in Aquinas' sources, well, where does pusillanimity come from? And it turns out it's kind of an offspring symptom vice of sloth. And I was like, well, now I don't know what sloth is. So then I had to track back into all of Aquinas' sources, like, where does sloth come from? And who's talking about that? And why did they choose this? And how did they define it? And so I wound up back in the fourth century of the Christian tradition in the deserts of Egypt with the desert fathers and mothers. And here we are, and here's the book. So it's kind of like, here's what I found. Here's how this tradition read me, and here's how I hope it can read you too. Mm-hmm. It reads our lives and shows us a way to go.
Yeah, I think I love that. And I wonder if for listeners like myself, hearing this and thinking, wow, that's such a neat way kind of like to follow the rabbit trail mm-hmm. and find something that is really significant, but immediately taking it back to, you know, which selfish people are prone to do. But why does this matter to me? And why does this matter even for a modern person like me today? Why should I study someone like an Aquinas? Why should I study these vices and these virtues? Wasn't that so long ago? People today and society today is so different than what it was in the fourth century.
I don't deny that there's some translation work that needs to happen. I will say this, though. Ever since Adam and Eve, there is nothing new under the sun when it comes to human sin. And the great thing about this seven deadly sins tradition is that it wasn't really initially designed to be the worst things that you could do. They were meant to be kind of a top 10 list of common human pitfalls that everyone is going to stumble over. So the idea is whatever you're reading about this tradition or within this tradition, you're going to see yourself in the mirror. It's a kind of self-examination project. So in philosophy, we do self-examination for a living. That's kind of reflecting on your life and thinking about how you're living it. And what I tell my students is you can avoid examining your life at your own peril. I mean, you're going to be living a certain kind of life, whether you reflect on it or not. And you're going to be committed to a picture of the good, whether you reflect on it or not. So it's kind of a high stakes operation, right? It's inevitable that you have to do this work and your life will be giving an answer. So let's think about what kind of answer we're giving and what goods we're organizing our lives around. And this tradition, I think, has kind of perennial human wisdom in a similar way that philosophers like Socrates saying, hey, you should examine your life. Well, that's not something that applied only in sort of 5th century Athens. That still applies right now. We might give different nuances to our answer now or have to translate things forward. But the pitfalls are very common, very familiar, and the solutions and the practices are the same too. My favorite example is the vice of vainglory. It's another one no one's ever heard of. It was a really big deal in this early tradition. They were like preoccupation with your image as a wise, virtuous, and respectable Christian. That's super important. And now I'm like, oh, let's translate this one forward.
Yeah.
What about how you're presenting yourself and your Christian faith on social media? Oh, okay. Most people are not like, well, I don't know how that applies to me today. People are like, oh, that hits way too close to home. So usually my reaction to this material is, yikes, that definitely speaks to me. Yeah. I'm not sure how this stuff will land.
Right.
That's been my experience with students, which is, I think, kind of fun.
Yeah.
It's illuminating. Yeah. It's like an epiphany.
Yeah, I feel like I need to bow out now as the host of this.
Figuring yourself out. Well, my profession.
That last one stung a little bit.
I know. Well, it should sting for everybody, though. I mean, I get up in front of people and talk for a living. Yeah. So it's kind of the signature thing I have to deal with in my profession. But even if you don't get up in front of people, you know, vainglory can be anything as simple as, you know, the way that you use language to talk about your spiritual life, to signal certain things about either how modest you are or about how humble you are about your own spiritual growth or your prayer life. I mean, we're always doing image management. Yeah. And everyone's doing it, not just people in the limelight. People in the trenches are doing this. The example I always use is when I went to church with really small children, we did not want to be sitting in the front row. Why is that? Well, there was this image of a perfect Christian family with well-behaved children who didn't get screamed at in the minivan on the way to church that I was trying to live into and live up to. And that was kind of crippling my ability to be honest with God about where I really was in my parenting and in my life with God and with my struggles with my children, who were honestly wonderful and not bad at all. But at any rate, you get the idea. We're all living into images of what we should be, that we feel like we're falling short of. And that's vainglory level stuff. It's everyday, everybody kind of stuff. And that's what the desert tradition was trying to tell us. This isn't just, you know, sin for the worst sinners. This is everyday sin.
Yeah.
Everybody kind of stuff.
That's good. I want to step back just for a second, and then I want to dive right back in. You know, you think about the mission of the church, and just to connect the dots and how I kind of see this fitting into a podcast series like this. Yeah, the Bible calls us to live in and not of the world. And what you just described is a sin that some people might say, is that really all that bad? And I'm sure that there are a lot of these sins that you kind of are illuminating in your book that we might look at and say, is it really that serious? Like, is it really wearing on my soul the way that you have kind of described it? So maybe my question would be this. So you've already mentioned two. What would be, and I don't know if you have time to mention all of it, like we want to hear all of it, but what are some that you would say, even as you've talked to people about the content of your book, like things that have stood out to others, mm-hmm. things that might, what has been maybe one of the ones where the response has been greater, where people have said, oh, is that right. really all that bad?
Yeah, you definitely touch a nerve.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
With your audience, yeah.
Yeah, I would say one of the ones that is probably the hardest to talk about is greed or avarice, in part because it's the air we breathe. Mm. And at least in a U.S. context,
tell us
many
tell
Christians
us more about
are
that.
Well yeah. off. And very happy being well off, and they feel very blessed by God being well off. And what's the problem? Like, mm-hmm. Abraham was rich and he used his money well, so what's the problem? And like, well, Jesus did talk about money and its deforming power more than any other power or principality. So there's that. But trying to think about the subtle ways in which our lives get organized around an excessive attachment to being the possessor of stuff. Mm-hmm. So the vices are habits of the heart, primarily destructive ones. So I'm not looking so much for how much money you make or what your income is, but rather how attached are you to the thought of being someone who can provide for yourself?
That's really good.
And who makes your life really safe and secure because you have this all in hand, your 401k is well stocked, you've got your kids' college paid for, you know, you've got like your ducks in a row, you feel secure. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of what the disciplines of the desert were for is this kind of detachment exercise. What if we pulled a few of these crutches, these rugs away? Would your trust in God still be on the same kind of footing? Mm-hmm. And that's a different kind of question than how much money do you make and do you tithe enough and do you give enough to your church and that kind of stuff. Like, because most people do that. Most Christians I know are very faithful givers and they think they've checked that box and they're done. And I'm like, no, let's do a heart check here. Mm-hmm. What would it look like if you really had to give up the thing that makes you feel secure? Mm-hmm. And you also just notice all these little ways that greed infiltrates your life. Like, most of your conversation is about what you've bought, what you paid for it, what you're planning on buying, what you're shopping for, the advertisements you find compelling, and your next vacation and all your hopes for going to this cool place that everyone else is going to. And it's all about how you're spending money. And I have found that very convicting in my own life. And that kind of internal conviction is the work that the desert is trying to get us to do. Any other questions?
I don't know if I can handle anymore, but I want to keep pressing in here because you, even how you described habits of the heart, and I, if our listeners are experiencing anything like what I'm experiencing, it's like a thank you for exposing that. But what are other habits of the, like that? Because you specifically mentioned, you know, the American church. What are some other American church habits that you have seen that you feel like the Lord might use? Yes, your book, but really, kind of this older these older disciplines to help kind of unearth that we've lived with so long. Like you mentioned, greed. We've lived with so long that we don't even notice them anymore.
Yeah, I want to be very clear that it was as hard for me to write the book as it is for anybody to read it. So I got to the sloth chapter and I thought, oh, good, I'm a busy, busy, productive person. At least I don't have this one. And then I read what Aquinas thought sloth was, and I thought, shoot, I have this one too. So I felt newly convicted in every chapter that I was writing. So I expect that to be a kind of common experience that everyone shares. It's not a finger-pointing exercise, and it's primarily not for cultural discernment. It's really for self-examination. Mm-hmm. But let's face it, there's no such thing as an isolated individual self. We are all formed in community, so our communities are also deformed, given that our hearts are deformed. So mm-hmm. we can gain communal practices that lean us in the wrong direction and that mess our lives up. One vice that my students often ask about, many of them are student athletes, and many of them are in competitive disciplines, or they're trying to compete in their profession to kind of level up and be mm-hmm. successful. And that's envy, because envy is all about competition. Mm-hmm. So is competition bad? They'll ask me, can I still be a competitive athlete and not be envious? And how do I think about that? And the thing about envy is that it's really about a comparative conception of the self. I only believe I'm worthy of love and a worthy human if I'm better than somebody else, mm-hmm. and preferably in a way that shows. So mm-hmm. envy and vainglory can get paired off that way. Mm-hmm. In fact, I like to think of pride, vainglory, and envy as a kind of unholy trinity of vices, mm-hmm. because in pride, you can be too attached to having a higher status. It's good for me to be superior to you. And that's a comparative relationship. So if I become inferior to you, then I'm going to be resentful. You hear the envy there. And vainglory, I want to make sure everybody knows where the lay of the land is, that I'm on top and you're down below, and that makes me better, and that mm-hmm. makes me secure, and that makes me feel worthy about myself. Mm-hmm. Like that's a toxic mix right there.
Yeah.
So that's a place where my students are worrying about competition, which is a part of their everyday lives, and thinking, how can this be corrupted? How can this go well? How can I do competition in a healthy way? How can I seek excellence and be in competitive environments that push me to be more excellent, to use my gifts well, without getting those claws sunk into my self-worth? How can I have my self-worth anchored in God's unconditional belovedness for me, and then compete out of that belovedness mm-hmm. rather than trying to earn my way into belovedness
yeah.
by winning the competition?
Yeah.
And that really lands for them, because they're at a kind of insecure mm-hmm. identity formation, figuring themselves out stage of life. So getting those two things untangled is really freeing. And yeah. that, I think, is the picture that I want people to get with the vices. Once you figure out what's holding you back, oh, well, there's a path toward freedom here. And mm-hmm. that leads to a more joyful,
yeah.
freedom to love mm-hmm. kind of life. And that's what we're really going for.
Yeah. And it sounds like at the heart of studying these vices, really the goal is to get to the heart of God and our connection with Him, and identifying what those possible barriers or obstacles may be. And those are hard things to call out in and of ourselves. So mm-hmm. I think we do the introspective work, but what other things might you suggest for us to kind of stay on target toward this connectedness to God?
That's a great question. I mean, so much of, I would say, American self-help literature and the Christian side of that can be very individualistic. Like, you're working on yourself, what's in my own heart. Well, that's work that really needs to be done. I'm not against self-examination. I do it for a living. However, we do that as a member of the body of Christ. So your community, the body of Christ around you, is a community both of encouragement and accountability.
Yeah.
So your safety with them in exposing the places there you need to grow, and then your ability and your willingness to lean on them and depend on them, and their encouragement and their example in order to be motivated to grow and keep growing, even when it's hard. We really need each other. So when I think about the spiritual disciplines that this wisdom tradition recommends and has kind of vetted over time, and the ways to translate those forward, I'm always trying to think about the ways in which they would operate communally, because that stabilizes the life, because it's a life together, but it also enables us to see things in each other that we don't necessarily want to see in ourselves. It allows us to expose things about ourselves in safety to each other. It takes a very hospitable and trustworthy community to get that real spiritual growth work done. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say, if the church lives into that calling, I'm 100% for it. Yeah. I think that's something that we could focus more on, helping each other to grow into wholehearted communion with God. Mm-hmm. Friendship with God is the thing that this is all for. What if we were more focused on that than moral policing? That would be awesome. Yeah. I think that would be a huge step forward.
Yeah, yeah. And even as you say that, like, I immediately think, yeah, our church body, right? But then also to individual family units.
Sure.
Right? Yeah. So I think about marriages. I think about parenting. Mm-hmm. And certainly even for the singles that are out there, and where are they finding that kind of sense of community and family of God? Mm-hmm. And again, just the importance of the bride of Christ, right? Paul often talks about the church as being the bride of Christ and being connected together as mm-hmm. a body. You know, we're built up together as living stones. And yeah. that is such a challenge, but it's also a very worthy target to go after. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's also, I think the caution here is to not to be super idealistic, but to find your people, mm-hmm. right? It's not the case that everyone in your congregation has to be mm-hmm. a point person for you, or a safe person for you, or a spiritually authentic mentor That's for right. you. You need to find two or three people mm-hmm. And build a community of accountability. Start there. If you're doing it right, it will grow. And your impact will grow. Yeah. So that when you were talking about being in the world but not of the world, mm-hmm. If you are living an authentic witness, it shines. Yeah. And that will be a light. And mm-hmm. people will start asking you, what you got going on over there? Right. How come your friendships are rich and trustworthy and safe and helping you grow into more beautiful people? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's a question worth asking. I would love to be asked that question. Yeah. I hope my life is somehow, someday, gets to the point where that kind of question is mm-hmm. the question that people ask. Yeah. So that's, I think, ultimately a call to witness. Mm-hmm. Not necessarily to change everything. I mean, sometimes change is possible and sometimes it's not. But where opportunities to sort of expand the community are presented, mm-hmm. then definitely mm-hmm. take advantage of that.
Well, and what you're describing, you know, experiencing the gospel really is the goal.
Yeah.
The confession of sin is the means.
Yeah.
It's mm-hmm. it's allowing God to kind of dig deeper. Sorry. No pun intended.
That's all you did there.
You see what I did there? To dig deeper there, but not that we might wallow in shame,
right.
but that his love and grace could be poured out in those areas of our life, both from him through his word and from others. So before we kind of land the plane, and we'll each, I'll have one more question. How about Jimmy has one more? You very lightly touched on sloth, but you never, and you said that you felt convicted even as a busy person. Tell us a little more about that.
Sloth is usually not a short conversation for me, but I'll do my best to summarize. The way that we normally think about sloth in our culture, the way we typically use the term, means to be lazy. And we often think of that as being lazy about work or effort. The way that the tradition thought about sloth was being lazy about the demands of love. So imagine yourself in a long-term committed love relationship that's going to require you to change, be transformed in certain ways, be stretched, be challenged, and keep growing. Mm-hmm. And it lasts a really long time. And it starts feeling hard. Mm-hmm. And you're feeling like you're not making a whole lot of progress. And maybe you're getting a little bit stuck. And maybe you're getting a little tired. That's the dynamic of sloth in the tradition. So they're thinking about sanctification as this lifelong growth opportunity to grow closer and closer to God, more and more wholehearted in your love for him, less and less hindered by any obstacle. And it turns out sometimes you're your own worst enemy on that journey, that you're getting tired of the long course of a lifetime. You're getting tired of all the demands. You see sanctification not in terms of a joyful reunion with God, but as a long, slow slog toward who knows where. So the idea that we can get stuck and bogged down in the process is where sloth gets to work. So the Israelites in the desert are the classic biblical portrait of sloth. Exodus, hooray, moment of celebration, big rescue. Everybody's for that, right? Mm-hmm. It's like going to a religious revival and everybody comes home on fire and you have to go back to your local church. And now where's the fire, right? So it's that kind of, how do I work this out in a daily sustainable rhythm where I don't get stuck, I don't get bogged down, and I don't lose sight of my first love and the joy that came with it.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's so good. That's a very, it's the pulling of the curtain, right? Pulling back of the curtain of what you typically might think of a vice like sloth. And so that's good to hear.
Yeah. Did you have a last question?
Well, I do. I always want to keep it super practical. And so as I hear this, and for someone who's kind of an approval addict, so to say, fear of rejection is kind of one of those low level things that's just kind of always simmering in the back. How does this kind of study and research into this, or just reading about this, how can I also be reminded of grace for each day, for each moment, and not get so caught up my failure?
Yeah, it's easy to become a kind of Martin Luther about this kind of confession stuff, and you get caught in the churn and you can't get back out of it. Well, what was Luther's solution? It's by grace you've been saved through faith, and this not that anyone should boast. So it's like, have you started your confession with the grace and the gift of your belovedness before God? Anchor yourself spiritually there before you get into any confession work. I think a lot of us skip that step. We start with, we're worthless sinners, and we need to be saved by grace. And I have no idea why God would save us, because we've forgotten our belovedness. Yeah. Like, the reason he's saving you is because he loves you, you're his child, and he wants you to come home forever and to be with him forever. That's the whole point of the project. So to think about sin the way that this tradition does is to think of Christ as the physician of souls. Mm-hmm. You go to the doctor, you might get a bad diagnosis. Why do you go to the doctor to get a bad diagnosis? To feel bad about your diagnosis and to go home and wallow in shame about the fact that you have a deadly disease? No, you go to the doctor because the doctor's the one who can heal you. So the whole idea is, this is my point person. This is the person who is my advocate, who will be my surgeon, my rehab partner, and my wellness coordinator for the rest of my life. This That's person so is for me. And for my health and flourishing. So to come to God with that frame, I think, is a more healthy way to keep the sin piece in the right space and keep it from kind of taking over.
That's good.
Certainly the foundation of a way we're thinking about our life with God.
That's great. So helpful.
That really is. Thank you so much for being with us. Again, Jimmy, can I see the book for a second?
Yeah, absolutely.
Again, the book, for anyone that's watching, on Glittering Vices, a new look at the seven deadly sins and their remedies. And today you have not only reminded us why the rich work of sanctification is part of the mission of the church, but I've been reminded of how self-examination is vital in the life of the believer, and how God's grace is just abounding for any one of us who is willing to come before the Lord as broken and needy people as we are. So thank you for today. And also thank you for what you're doing and what you've been doing for 25 years, pouring into this next generation of leaders at Calvin. We just so appreciate your time.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
Yeah, and thanks, Jimmy, for standing in for Jeff.
Yeah, I hope I did an okay job.
He missed a great one.
Yeah, he did.
Jeff, if you're listening right now, you missed a really good one. And for everyone listening, thanks again for joining us. We are in the middle of this incredible season. So we have so many more great things to come about God's mission, both here and our next few, I'll just go ahead and tell you, are very excited. I cannot wait. We get to hear from some people like Katie Davis Majors and the Ellises and Sandy Wilson. So lots of more people to join the conversation. But thanks so much for tuning in with us today.